So now we're going to move from the hydrology discussions to water quality. And we're going to start with surface water quality, and that's going to be presented by Mark Stelgis. He's the author of that chapter of the EBD. Mark Stelgis is the Director of Risk Assessment and Toxicology for SLR International Corporation. He has a PhD in environmental toxicology and pharmacology from the University of California, Davis, and a master's degree in wildlife biology from the University of Missouri. He's been conducting human health and ecological risk assessments since 1990. He has published a book for non-toxicology for the layperson. The title is Toxicology for Non-Toxicologists. It's in its second edition. On the project, the Pebble Project, he's managed the trace elements work since 2005 and has evaluated all the surface water data. As I mentioned, that's what's been presented in the EBD. He prepared sections 9.1, that's the surface water quality section, chapter 10, that's the trace elements section, and chapter 35 is also trace elements for the transportation corridor of the EBD itself. His hobbies here he has listed are hanging out at Anchorage in the winter, actually midwinter, and then standing out in the rain with no coat, tongue in cheek. There's a comment I wanted to make here. Oh, about trace elements. For this project, when we say trace elements, what we mean are the very, very, very low concentrations of primarily metals that are in the periodic chart. We actually test for 27 different elements in our trace elements program. And trace elements is distinct from water quality, where water quality, we actually have a greater number of parameters that we test for in water. So the trace elements is confined to solid samples, and that would be soils, sediments, fish tissues, animal tissues, sediments from the marine environment, et cetera. Just so you get that distinction in our program, the trace elements is analysis of solid samples, and then the water quality, of course, is the analytical work for our water sample collection program. With that, I'd like to welcome Mark Stelgis.
Thanks, Jane. Good morning, everybody. See if I can figure out how to operate this. Okay. So I am going to be talking about actual data and give you more graphs to look at. If you get sick of my graphs, then just wait another hour after the break and you can look at some more from Hugh. And if you like mine, then stick around for after lunch and you can see some more of mine. So just to start off here, let's see. I'm going to first talk about the stream program, an overview of what we collected and how we did it, and then some results and discussion talking about spatial and temporal trends. And I'll do that by each of the watersheds, and do the same thing for seeps, and then spend a few minutes talking about ponds. I could easily spend the rest of the day presenting this information. I'm going to be trying to go quite quickly and hit just some high points. So our objective for this program is to collect baseline data in streams, lakes, and seeps so that we can find out what's there, how much of it is there, and how does it change over time. Identify how many seeps there are and where they are, and characterize the flow and water chemistry that you've heard a lot about, the flow already today and yesterday, and then to provide a database of the mine study area water chemistry. And we can then utilize that as we move on with the program and the project. A lot of different consulting firms were involved in this. We evaluated the data. R-squared oversaw and advised the water quality program for 2 years. HDR did almost all of the field sampling over this entire 8-year period. And then APC has also managed collecting some of the samples in the lower upper Tularic. That's just the field teams. Then we also had several analytical laboratories that were involved in analyzing all of these data. Some of these are specialty labs that looked at specific types of chemistry. The primary labs were SGS, CAS, and Test America. We have 8 years of water quality data. The water quality section is one that we had to cut off the data after 2008 because it was too large a level of effort to try to update it annually after that. Have about 134 stream sampling events since 2004. Up to 44 locations were sampled at a given time. Currently there's 26 locations regularly sampled. Started sampling monthly in the summertime and just twice in the winter, but changed that to monthly year-round to help assist with all the surface water hydrology and the groundwater modeling that you've just seen, so that we could get better understanding of the low flow conditions in the winter. We have a lot of data points, over 130,000 parameter results for rivers and 55,000 results for seeps. So I stand here with a straight face and tell you that this is the largest, most robust data set in surface water I have ever seen for something that's not even, that we haven't done anything with. So this is an incredible baseline of data for surface water quality. The transportation corridor I'm only going to talk about for this one slide because there hasn't been a whole lot of water quality collections on the transportation corridor study area. You can read about it in the EBD. I'm going to be focusing on the mine study area here today. We have about 32,000 parameter results and 340 samples, and six stations were sampled 12 times, and we had another 18 locations that were sampled a few times. And the goal was to really just get a general idea of what the water quality was like in stream crossings as you go along the transportation corridor. And so we routinely analyzed 25 trace elements, 9 major cations, and then general water quality parameters like pH, total dissolved solids, total suspended solids, alkalinity, hardness. We also looked for cyanides, naturally occurring cyanides, both total and another analytical method to evaluate cyanide is called weak acid dissociable cyanide. And so we looked at both of those measures of cyanide. Dissolved organic carbon was added in June of 2007. And that way we could try to get some correlations between organic carbon and concentrations of some elements because they can adsorb to the organic carbon. And then we had isolated analyses for looking at a whole spectrum of chemicals, semi-volatile organic compounds, volatile organic compounds, pesticides. None of those were found in the isolated samples that we collected, and we did not do anything more with those types of chemicals. We did look at petroleum products, diesel range organics, gasoline range organics, and benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylenes. And we found that there was nothing there, and so we discontinued that. So there hadn't been any kind of spills or petroleum hydrocarbons out there that you wouldn't expect since there's no roads. So we just confirmed that the only thing that's really out there are metals and cations, anions. Okay, it's not liking me. Trying to find a line of sight here. All right, what's going on? There. Okay. Sampling locations. This is out of the EBD. Every one of the orange dots is a water quality sampling location in streams. you can't see any of the labels here, but the obviously the ones on the top here are in the North Fork, and then these down here are Clark, and then we have South Fork. These are the drainage boundaries that you see on many of the figures in the EBD. This is the North Fork drainage. this is the Upper Clark drainage and South Fork drainage. So let's take a look at the general stream quality now by drainage. there are some things that are consistent across all three drainages. Not many, but there are some, and this is this list here. pH is just around 7 in pretty much all the drainages. The temperatures are all low. By low, I mean 5 degrees centigrade or lower most of the year. I think that was a question yesterday. Hardness is also low across drainages. There's some spatial variability by drainage, but the take-home message here is that the hardness is very low. We have very soft water up there. Fluoride, ammonia, antimony, mercury, and cyanide were essentially non-detect pretty much everywhere. And then a large list of about a dozen analytes had very little spatial variation. They were consistent most everywhere. If you look at those, you'll see that from a toxicology and a risk standpoint, lead and zinc are the only two that really stand out there in terms of things that can cause toxicity at relatively low levels. I don't know what's going on with my pointer here, but it doesn't seem to be forwarding the slides. Let's try this one. Okay, I might have to stop. There. I've skipped some slides here. This works, okay. Okay, one of the general ways that you look at water quality is to develop something called a Piper plot. A Piper plot is something that tells you the type of water that you have in your system. If you look at these three pyramids, or these two, this one diamond and the two triangles all go together. When you look at this, these things, increasing sulfate and chloride in this direction, increasing calcium and magnesium in this direction, and then you have increasing sodium and potassium in this direction. These are all the sample locations and sample results for sulfate, chloride, calcium, magnesium, carbonate, sodium, and potassium. You put all those together, and you could see when you look at that, down here you have calcium on this axis and magnesium here, and here you've got chloride, sulfate. So you can look at where all of these different points show up on the slide. So, for example, right here, you could see that almost all of these samples are primarily low in sodium and potassium. They're low in sulfate and chloride. They're high in calcium and magnesium, and they're high in carbonate. You look over here, you see the same thing, that pretty much all of these samples are relatively high in calcium, relatively low in magnesium, and relatively high in sodium and potassium. So when you put all these things together, and you can say that this is predominantly a calcium bicarbonate sulfate water system. Look at the same thing with the South Fork Cocktooley. And here you can see there's a little bit of a difference, primarily calcium bicarbonate. If I go back to the slide before, like that, you can see the difference here is that you've got quite a bit of you have low sulfate here, low chloride, high carbonate. You go down to this one, and it's a little bit more spread out. You go from low, very low chloride, high carbonate, and a scattering of sulfate up and down. So you have a wider range in the South Fork than you do in the North Fork of sulfate. And you look at the upper Tularic, again, same thing. Here you have two different groups. You have one group that's primarily calcium bicarbonate with a little bit of sulfate, and you have another group that has basically no sulfate in it. So the point of these slides is not so much to get into detail. It's to show you the similarities and contrasting the different types of carbonate systems that we have in the different water bodies. They are generally similar to each other. As you expect, since you have a lot of groundwater, surface water interaction, and you have interbasin transfer, you should see a lot of similarities amongst these rivers than you do. Spatial variation, of course, is very important. And this can come from groundwater contributions, as we've already heard, aquifer characteristics. What you're going to find as you read through the EBD and the surface water section is that there are a lot of microclimate patterns that really affect very small stretches of each of these rivers. Surface soil characteristics, and then there's areas where sediments deposit and can be resuspended. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can have variability in your data set, both seasonally and spatially. Here I'm just talking about spatial. So getting closer in with the spatial variation, the within drainage variation. So this is, say, now you're looking at just the South Fork Coctuli or just the Upper Tularuk. Many constituents are inversely proportional to flow. So not surprising. You start with the headwaters at relatively higher concentrations of things like copper and molybdenum, as you'd expect. As you go downstream, those concentrations go down, and the water flow goes up, inverse proportional, inversely related. There are others that are directly proportional. As the flow goes up, so does the concentration of the chemical. Arsenic and chloride are a couple of examples there. And you don't really see that very much in the North Fork because it doesn't really go through or traverse that deposit area. So you're not seeing that variability as much in the North Fork as you do in the South Fork and the Upper Tularuk. And I'll show you some examples of that with some slides here. not too interested here in the numbers. What we're looking at here on the x-axis horizontally are upstream to downstream. On the left axis is the median concentration. In this case, we have molybdenum here on the left side, and we have potassium on the right side of the screen. And then we have median stream flow. This is in cubic feet per second, and this is an annualized average for the whole drainage. So all of those ups and downs have all been taken away, and now what you're looking at is the overall average flow. But as you go downstream, the flow goes up, as you'd expect. And most of the time, the concentrations go down. The blue represents the concentrations of the chemicals. The green represents the flow. So if you look at the potassium, South Fork, and Upper Tularuk, you have essentially the same pattern in both. Concentrations go down with distance from the headwaters. There's a unique difference with molybdenum in the South Fork. So here we have molybdenum in the South Fork where it's inversely proportional, and in the Upper Tularuk it's directly proportional. And I was scratching my head trying to figure out why molybdenum would behave differently in these two different systems. And then I think that what's going on is because we have that interbasin transfer between the South Fork and the Upper Tularuk, you're getting some additional molybdenum being transferred because it's pretty soluble. It's getting into the Upper Tularuk, and then it's raising the concentration of molybdenum as you go downstream in the Upper Tularuk. That's just a hypothesis, but it may make some sense. Now let's switch and start looking across river systems. Still talking generally here. There are four parameters that differed significantly. So what I did was I took all the data from all the different drainages and I ran statistical tests to see were any of these parameters significantly different from each other by drainage. And I came across four that were total dissolved solid, total suspended solid, pH, and alkalinity. You'll remember in an earlier slide I said that pH was relatively consistent. And it is everything's about neutral, but there are significant differences because the pH is so consistent that very little change is significant in a statistical test. And then there were five major ions that also differed significantly across the river systems, sodium chloride, sulfate, fluoride, and hardness. One nutrient, nitrate and nitrite, differed significantly, and then all, literally all of the analyzed trace elements differed significantly except cadmium and lead. So when you have three different rivers, two of which are at least in parts reversing a deposit and one that isn't, you would expect there to be some significant differences in the water quality, and there are. So let's take a look at these now by drainage. The North Fork Coctuli on a relatively nice day. By the way, I'm not the one that got to take all these fun pictures. So let's look at the North Fork Coctuli. We have 241 samples collected from the North Fork Coctuli that are in the EBD between 2004 and 2008. Six main stem sample locations and one tributary sampling location. And all of the sample locations were well away from the general deposit area. So the North Fork had the highest concentrations of cadmium and lead of all three of the drainages. We had the pH getting slightly more basic as you go from upstream to downstream. And potassium, nickel, and total dissolved solids were significantly decreasing with distance downstream. These chemicals that I'm presenting here are all significantly different, otherwise they don't make it on the slides. South Fork Coctuli, the same information. We have 612 samples there from 11 main stem and 7 tributary locations. And here, you know, this drains the general deposit area. We have that intermittent stretch midstream that goes dry. And here, not surprisingly, we have our highest concentrations of copper, molybdenum, sulfate, total suspended solids, nickel, and selenium. Just what you would really expect since it starts right around where the deposit is. And you have the lowest concentration of TDS, or total dissolved solids, in the South Fork. And most of the concentrations of the chemicals decline as you go downstream and you get further away from the deposit. Now the Upper Tularic, look at the same set of information, 509 samples from 8 mainstream and 7 tributary locations. Drains a portion of the mineral deposit, not quite as much as the South Fork. It's the highest of all drainages in many of the water quality parameters, alkalinity, total dissolved solids, pH, hardness, sodium, calcium, magnesium. And only a few chemicals decrease significantly as you go downstream. As I mentioned before, arsenic and chloride were different in this drainage in that they both increased downstream, as did molybdenum, and I just explained why I think that's occurring. Now, we also looked at Cascadet Creek, although here we only have one sample location, so there's no spatial trends that we can evaluate. Notice here that we had the highest of all drainage concentrations for iron and arsenic and cyanide. So this is a naturally occurring creek that's really not interacting with the deposit area or a study area at all. And we're still seeing things like cyanide intermittently present. So these are naturally generated cyanide, probably through bacteria, that lead to low levels of cyanide in the water. And this afternoon you'll hear some of the same things about the trace elements in the solid samples that also have cyanide. And this Cascadet Creek had the lowest flow of all of the systems we looked at. Now, one of the important aspects of water quality obviously is what are the concentrations and how do they compare to water quality standards. There are naturally occurring concentrations above criteria in all of the drainages out of the site. We compared all the site concentrations to the State of Alaska Chronic Aquatic Life criteria as well as the EPA drinking water standards. And many of those are hardness adjusted or pH adjusted, and those adjustments were made and will appear on these slides. We're calling this naturally occurring elevated concentrations rather than saying that these concentrations exceed our exceedances, because they're naturally occurring, and so it's likely going to be that if these are relatively higher than the standards and they're naturally occurring, then we may need to get a site-specific criterion developed. And there may be several of those that we'll need to do that for based on these data. So those, which chemicals are above criteria? There's a pH and dissolved oxygen are out of the range in some samples. Alkalinity is actually lower, below the lowest criteria. Quad cyanide, where it appears, almost always exceeds its criteria. And then several metals, aluminum, iron, copper, lead, cadmium, manganese, and zinc in two of the three drainages. So this is an important point, because it shows you that, you know, obviously for the primary chemical of concern with the deposit is copper, and not surprisingly, we have quite a few naturally occurring concentrations above the copper standard. we don't for molybdenum. So now let's look at some things that happen over time with each of these drainages. The contribution of sources, as you've heard a lot about yesterday and this morning already, vary in proportion and quality by time, by season. Open water season stream flow is a combination of, you know, groundwater, snowmelt, precipitation. And then you can get seasonal high flows can lead to greater dilution or greater erosion, resuspension, flushing of groundwater. So you're definitely getting some, you're expecting to see some changes over time for the surface water system, especially considering what you saw in the groundwater system with the seasonal fluctuations. The surface water should be more affected by seasonal fluctuations than the groundwater when you think about it. During freezing conditions, the stream flows are groundwater fed, as you've heard this morning. As you can't get any, obviously you're not going to get any water entering the system when it has to go through ice. Other components can be precipitated, which can lead to higher sediment concentrations in the wintertime. But you also can have higher concentrations of chemicals in this more concentrated, smaller volume of water. You have the same amount of chemical, less water, you're going to have a higher concentration. So that's kind of a byproduct of having lower amount of water in the system, but you're not losing your chemicals. So concentrations go up as the amount of water goes down, and then in the summertime, or the springtime when you get the snow melt and everything, that brings the concentrations back down because you have additional water entering the system and the same amount of mass of your chemical. So I will show these individually, but I wanted to show these. These are from the upper Talarc. All three of these slides represent one chemical, because there are so many different locations. Each one of these lines represents a sample location from January through December for, in this case, it's alkalinity on the left, hardness in the middle, and iron on the right. And I'm trying to show some typical patterns here. Each color is a different sample location. So while you can see that there's variability by sample location in terms of these concentrations, you see the same basic trends that you saw in groundwater, that you have it's reversed. So you have a high relatively high concentration in the wintertime on the left-hand side of these graphs, and then as you get to spring breakup, you get a large drop in concentrations as additional water enters the system, and then those concentrations go back up as the summer progresses and the amount of water goes down slightly through evapotranspiration. In other cases, although this is much less common, you'll have the opposite pattern occur. So those first two were for water quality parameters. This one on the right is for iron. And so what I was talking about before, where when you have less water in your system, such as in January. Most of the iron is precipitated out, and so you don't have very much there. In the spring breakup, you get a higher concentration as you remobilize your iron and put it back in the water system. So this shows the close-ups of each of those three slides, each of those three graphs that I had just put up on the screen. So you can see actually what the sample locations are and look at the concentrations if you so wish. We're talking about pretty low iron concentrations here. This is 0.2 milligrams per liter, is about as high as it gets in the South Fork. So I didn't provide a lot of detail in this. I'm trying to provide you with a basic overview that compares and contrasts the different drainages and shows you that there are some similarities and there are some differences. In general, concentrations decline with distance away from the deposit, and the North Fork has less of many chemicals than do the other two systems due to the difference in location of that stream. The background signatures, this third bullet is important because it shows that the background concentrations of each of your chemicals is going to be different based on where in the drainage you are and in which drainage you are. So background is not one number. Background varies with distance and varies with season. And the concentrations of several parameters are naturally higher than the applicable regulatory-based limits. And let's move to seeps. You're doing basically presenting the same type of information, comparing and contrasting the three different drainages. Repeating the seep objectives, identify how many there are and where they are, and characterize their flow and chemistry, and what contributes to their to the variability of concentrations over time. Anywhere between 11 and 127 seeps were sampled each year, and seep sampling came and went over time with the program. In the last year of the EBD data set that's included in the surface water chapter, there were 28 locations sampled. And up to 5 events per year, trying to capture winter base flow, spring breakup, summer low flow, fall storm events, and then late fall. Overall, we have 650 seep samples included in the EBD. And here's the sample locations between 2004 and 2008. These are ones that were regularly sampled. Each of these little green dots, there's pretty well spread out, several in the upper Tularic along here. We have several in the North Fork, and then we have a few in the South Fork. Notice also we have 4 or 5 in the deposit area itself. Now, we look at Piper plots similarly for seeps like we did for streams, and these are very similar to what you saw for the North Fork Coctulee River. And you would expect that. Obviously, the seeps represent the interaction between groundwater and surface water, and so you should see a similar expression of surface water quality in seeps as you do in surface water and also as you would in groundwater. So you have the same basic pattern here that we saw for the streams, predominantly calcium bicarbonate with some sulfate. South Fork, if you recall that from the stream slide, it was there was much more variability along this axis, and we're seeing that as well for the seeps. So the seeps and the streams have very similar patterns in their anions and cations. In the upper Tularic Creek is again similar to the creek samples themselves. The seep samples are mimicking what the creek is doing, and this shows them again side by side. So the results for the seep program, generally have very low concentrations in March and April, and only from one station in the North Fork. Otherwise, there's little flow in those seeps. Concentrations then increase in May, and then we have different patterns for different chemicals, so there's not a generalization that you can make. In the South Fork Coctuli, we found every constituent except molybdenum. I'm sorry, just the opposite. We found only molybdenum. I was right the first time, excuse me. Only molybdenum was not detected in seeps. We found every other analyte that we were looking for. So what that tells us is that all those chemicals are naturally occurring in the groundwater because the seeps are an expression of groundwater. There were several trace element concentrations highest at two specific seeps, seep 26 and seep 41, and those are both within the general deposit area, and they're at lower elevation than the ore deposit. So basically, what you're seeing is you're getting seepage from the deposit area, groundwater popping out at those locations, and therefore you have higher concentrations of, for example, copper than you do in any of the other South Fork Coctuli seeps. And in the Upper Tularic, there were very few general trends that we could identify, other than saying that concentrations were generally low in March and we only found them in one location. This is a sample slide showing copper concentrations by month. When you look at this slide, it's natural to try to sum the bars, but these bars are not meant to be summed. What I'm showing you here is the contribution of concentration from two different seeps for copper in the six different months that these two seeps were sampled. So if you look at the South Fork Coctuli and copper, it only shows up in two seeps. It's non-detect in all of the other seeps that were sampled in this drainage. And when you look at these, you see that seep 26 and seep 42, seep 41, which are right there at the tips of that star. The northern point of the star is seep 26, and the point of the star at 4 o'clock is the other seep. So they're both right basically in the center of the deposit location. Okay, so how do I scroll back up here? And now I've lost my pointer thing again. Okay, this is the other one that I wanted to show you, which is nickel in the South Fork Coctuli seeps. Recall that I just showed you the copper one where SP26 and SP41 were the only two that contained copper. Now you look at nickel, and it gives you basically the same pattern, except now you're seeing that there's also a small contribution of nickel coming in from SP86 in red, and a very small amount from SP96 in August and September. So using these kinds of graphs, you can get an idea of the contribution of concentrations by time into a given drainage. And you put these together, you look at copper and nickel in South Fork Coctuli seeps, and you're basically seeing the same thing. Two seeps predominate in providing primarily providing the concentrations of nickel and copper into the South Fork. We are seeing quite a bit of spatial consistencies in the seep data, as we did for the river systems, generally near neutral pH. The temperature is a little bit colder than streams, about 3.5 degrees instead of 4 to 4.5 degrees, closer to the groundwater temperatures. Major ions exhibited the highest concentrations, as you would anticipate. And the range of discharge rates is 0 to 2 cubic feet per second, although the vast majority are less than 0.5 cubic feet per second, so relatively low flows. Measurable flow varies throughout the year, and it's affected by precipitation events. This shows one of the types of collecting methods of seeps here. And here's another method of collecting a seep. Similar to the streams, there were also naturally occurring concentrations above criteria in all of the drainages in many of the seep locations. pH and dissolved oxygen, the same two. Sorry. First call I've had all week. alkalinity, WAD cyanide, nitrate and nitrite. And in metals, all three drainages, we had aluminum, iron, cadmium, copper, lead, and arsenic all exceeding criteria, naturally occurring concentrations. And in the South Fork and Upper Tularic drainages only, we had four additional chemicals that had exceedances over or had concentrations above criteria: zinc, manganese, nickel, and mercury. Not the same set of chemicals that had the exceedances in the streams. Many of them are the same, but some of them are different. So don't have direct concordance there. We do have within drainage variation. This is very similar to what we saw with the streams. Several constituents are inversely proportional to discharge velocity. Okay, so concentrations get lower as the seep velocity increases. And that's true for total suspended solids, sulfate and iron in the North Fork, and for total dissolved solids, potassium, copper, and nickel in the South Fork. And we also have several constituents that are directly proportional to discharge velocities. It's alkalinity, total suspended solids, iron, lead, and molybdenum. So the way that we looked at this is we divided the seeps into three groups. Low flow seeps, which is less than 0.1 cubic feet per second, moderate flow seeps, and then high flow seeps, which is over one. And looking at this in the North Fork and Upper Tularic and this series of four graphs here, we're looking at total suspended solids, alkalinity, iron on the bottom. And what were the low flow seeps are in yellow, the moderate medium flow seeps are orange, and then the high flow seeps are in red. These horizontal lines represent the detection limits. So you can see that we have pretty low concentrations in these seeps. There, a lot of them hover right around the detection limits. But what this points out is that it's very clear, for example, in something like total suspended solids, that you have much higher concentrations on this axis is the concentration in low flow seeps than you do in high flow seeps. And you're seeing the same thing with iron as you do with total suspended solids in the North Fork. The low flow seeps are associated with higher concentrations. Now you look at alkalinity in the North Fork, and you see the opposite. The higher the flow, the higher is associated primarily with the higher concentrations. The lower flows are generally associated with the lowest concentrations. And then you get to iron in the Upper Tularic, and you're seeing something similar again, where you have your high flow gives you the highest concentrations, and the low flow gives you generally a lower concentration. Most of them do not provide these kinds of nice patterns, and they're all over the board. But these give you some of the patterns that we do see, is that most of the seeps at the site are low flow seeps. but they're not always the ones that give you the higher concentrations. I guess that's the take-home point. Comparison across the three different drainages for seeps. This is similar to what we just talked about for the rivers. Looking at statistically different concentrations within or across the drainages. Same four that we found significantly different in rivers, we also found different in seeps, TDS, or total dissolved solids, total suspended solids, pH and alkalinity. The same five major ions differed significantly as in the rivers, the same nutrient, and the same trace elements. So here we do have concordance. The things that were different in the rivers are also different in the seeps. So I had a five-bullet summary for rivers, and now I have a four-bullet summary for seeps because we had less to talk about here. Drainages have different signatures of naturally occurring constituents, and background signatures depend on, in part, on the distance from the deposit area, as you saw from those seeps 26 and 41, with quite high concentrations being right in the deposit location. Concentrations of several parameters in seeps are naturally higher than regulatory-based limits. Most concentrations are independent of seep velocity, but there's a few examples, such as the ones I showed you, where there are both direct and inverse relationships with seep flow. And spend the last few minutes talking about ponds. The ponds that we sampled are all shown here in blue, and this also includes all three drainages and two ponds from within the deposit location itself. Objectives were the same as for streams. Had 47 samples from 28 stations over 19 lakes, so a pretty widespread distribution of data points. We only went out and sampled once a year in August. There's also a small pool study that you'll hear about tomorrow, I believe, and this is separate from that. This wasn't done to try to identify wetlands and things like that. This was done purely to sample the water quality of the ponds. So there were three parameters that were essentially non-detect in all the pond samples. No suspended solids, at least below detection limits. No fluoride and no cyanide. Similar to the streams and the seeps, some lakes also have naturally occurring concentrations above criteria. The same ones that keep showing up in the rivers and the seeps, pH and dissolved oxygen. Here we do have some one detected sample of wad cyanide in Frying Pan Lake, and that exceeded the cyanide criteria. And then four metals, aluminum, copper, iron, and lead, but only in Frying Pan Lake. So we collected samples from most of the major lakes, as well as a dozen or so small lakes up there. The majority, the largest number of samples is from Frying Pan Lake. And that clearly has a different signature of parameter concentrations than the other lakes. This lake incorporates drainage from higher elevations around the deposit area. It's very shallow. It gives you lots of it. It's a very different looking lake than most of the other lakes in the area. And not surprisingly, you're seeing higher concentrations of some parameters like iron, but lower values of other parameters, which go hand in hand with higher concentrations of iron and sulfate. You're getting lower concentrations of pH, or lower values of pH, slightly acidic, very slightly acidic, I might add. And the three-bullet summary for ponds. Concentrations, we have some concentrations that are above criteria in ponds. Background signatures of naturally occurring constituents in ponds, again, depend on whether they drain the general deposit area, not whether they're in it, but whether they drain it. And Frying Pan Lake has a different signature parameters than do the other sampled lakes. Then get from the four, from the five-bullet summary to the four-bullet summary to the three-bullet summary, and now a two-word summary. Thanks. Anyway, sorry for the problems. I tried to have making my slides go forward and backward here, and hopefully you got some take-home points. Any questions?
So we have two here. Yeah. Okay, we'll take the one in the back first.
Hi, I'm Bob Seale, U.S. Geological Survey. There's been a lot of published studies that show a lot of dramatic diurnal or diurnal variations in surface water. Have you looked for that in any of the streams?
No. No, we haven't looked at daily changes.
I think it might be worth doing on at least a limited basis just to have an appreciation of how much variation
you
have.
It's a reasonable idea. Thanks, Bob.
Bill North, Environmental Protection Agency. I just need to clarify something. I'm right here. I thought you said that the two seeps that were on the deposit were the only two that were actually showing up significant levels of copper?
Those were the two seeps that were contributing copper to the South Fork, yes.
Okay, but other seeps did show copper in the other drainage.
The other seeps that we sampled in the South Fork did not have any copper contribution. They were below detection limits.
But the other streams, North Fork and Upper Telluric?
I don't recall. I believe that there were some detections of those chemicals in seeps for the North Fork and the Upper Telluric.
I think you had a point in there, a bullet, that said that copper and other metals were elevated in all the drainages.
In surface water, yes.
Well, in the seeps, it was a seep.
Oh, and in all, did I say all three drainages for copper?
I believe you did.
Okay.
I wrote down a note to ask.
Yeah, I just didn't provide you with the slides for the Upper Telluric and the North Fork, but they would look the same as the one from the South Fork, basically. Except those two seeps that provided the majority of the copper in the South Fork. all the other seeps are outside of the deposit area, so you're going to have lower concentrations of copper, but they're still slightly elevated over the calculated criterion.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. I wasn't sure it was consistent, so I wanted to clarify that.
Okay. And
then I have another question about the, yesterday we heard about a lot of other areas where there are possible deposits or there are deposits. I guess they haven't been delineated or quantified in any way, I suppose. I don't know. And I'm wondering if there were any seeps associated within any of those other deposits and if you had elevated levels of metals in those seeps, if there were.
I'm not quite sure which seeps it is that you're talking about.
Well, there was a discussion, and there were all these other, you know, the Sill prospect, and then Zone 37, and a bunch of others.
We haven't looked at those. I haven't looked at those seeps from a water quality perspective at all.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to add to Mark's comment, we haven't correlated the seep data with those other deposits that were brought out yesterday. Other questions?
Jason Mao with Fishing Game. I've noticed over the years and in your presentation today that the dissolved oxygen concentrations in the seeps appear to be uniformly high across sites and time. That's a little bit puzzling. Do you have any insight into that?
I wish I could say yes, but I don't really have an explanation for why the dissolved oxygen is high, but it clearly is.
Yeah, and I can comment on that also.
Okay.
It's actually consistent with the groundwater data, the high dissolved oxygen, and you'll hear a lot about that this afternoon. So yeah, it's a good point to raise, but it's pretty consistent with groundwater levels. Jason, did you give your last name? Jason Mao. Thank you very much.
Appreciate that. Any other questions? Okay.
Cindy Godsey, EPA. Can you tell me what hardness was used to calculate the water quality criteria that are hardness dependent?
Okay. I believe that we used the lower fifth percentile of the hardness across the all three drainages and used that as our hardness for adjusting the criteria.
Thank you.
Questions? Anyone else?
Hi, Mike Daniel with Fish and Game. Mark, I was just curious what sampling effort you guys have done since 2008 along the transportation corridor.
I don't believe that we've done any additional surface water quality work on the transportation corridor since 2008.
That's correct. Any more questions? Okay. Thanks very much, Mark.
Okay, I have one slight correction to make to one of the responses I gave to the on the surface water presentation about the where the how we did the hardness adjustment. I believe I said that we took the lower fifth percentile of the hardness across the entire site, which was actually not quite correct. We took the lowest fifth percentile for each sample location. And then use that to get a location-specific hardness-adjusted value. And so I just wanted to make sure that was clarified and got put into the record. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.